morning, and welcome to Fiberhood. I'm your host, Benjamin Levesay, and for the next hour or so, I'd like to invite you to grab your cup of coffee, tea, or Diet Dr. Pepper, if that's your beverage choice, and settle in for the 22nd episode of Fiber Hooligan. For those of you who are wondering who the heck I am the CEO of XRX Inc., home of Knitters Magazine, XRX Books, and Stitches Expos, and I'm broadcasting from my home here in Harrisburg, South Dakota. Due to a scheduling conflict, my guest was not able to join us for a live show. So this show was pre-recorded this weekend so we could still make our schedule. Before I get to the show today, I wanted to give you all an update on the podcast throwdown. According to Nathania at Pearlescence Yarns, the first of the hats are starting to roll in. I don't know for sure, but I think that at this point the Knitmore girls might have a small lead. I'm sure there might be some disagreement about that. Next week, on the 21st, I'll be on Ready, Set, Knit with Kathy and Steve Elkins talking about the throwdown. And I wouldn't be surprised if our friends at Webbs decided to join the rumble. I guess we'll see. You can learn more about this on our Ravelry group, Podcaster Throwdown, and I'll have updates at the top of every show. My guest today is someone that I've had the great privilege and pleasure of knowing for most of my life. She is a designer, author, entrepreneur, and a living legend in the fiber arts community. She was taught to knit by her mother, British-born designer and writer Elizabeth Zimmerman. She and her mother began to work together in 1965 and ran their knitting supply mail order business, Schoolhouse Press, until Elizabeth's retirement in 1990. Schoolhouse Press supplies hand knitters with books, wool, buttons, needles, kits, DVDs, and assorted tools. She was the first to be profiled in Vogue Knitting's Master Knitters of the 90s series, and her designs and articles have appeared in Knitters Magazine, Vogue Knitting, Threads, and Interweave Knits Magazine. She continues to publish books, design, and produce her semi-annual booklet, Wool Gathering, started by Elizabeth as a single-sheet newsletter in 1958, import wool from Iceland, Finland, Canada, and the Shetland Islands, produce a free electronic newsletter through her website, write articles for Vogue Knitting Magazine, and run four sessions of her summer knitting camp. She has written five knitting books and lives with her cats in an old schoolhouse in central Wisconsin. I'm speaking of the iconic Meg Swanson. Meg joins us from Pittsville, Wisconsin this morning. Good morning, Meg, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Benjamin. Thank you for inviting me.
This is a real treat, just not only for our listeners, but for me as well, Meg. I know you don't do a lot of these things, and I really do appreciate the time that you're spending with us.
Oh, no, I feel that we go way, way back. I've probably known you since you were a little kid, and this is wonderful that you're doing this, and I'm pleased that you're going to have me on. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Yes, it has been far too long since I have talked to you. So how are things in Pittsville?
Boy, things in Pittsville. humming along. I don't get to Pittsville very often. But, you know, Schoolhouse Press is motoring, and we're doing quite well. Thank you.
So, beautiful day today?
It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous early fall day. Absolutely beautiful. Sunny and cool.
So, Meg, we're recording this on Saturday morning, and it's your birthday today. Happy birthday.
Oh, it is my birthday. Thank you very much. This is a lovely present to be able to talk to you for an hour.
Well, I hope you're not going to spend too much time with us today. I hope you're going to go do some stuff with your family.
Absolutely. That's my plan as soon as we're done here.
Fantastic. Do you mind if I ask how the family's doing?
Family is doing well. My sister, Loie, you remember her, still running the restaurant. And, boy, it's going on 37 years or something, unheard of for a restaurant. And let's see, my brother is hopping around back and forth between countries. And my children are doing well. Liesl's in Madison, working mostly for the courts. She's a translator, interpreter in Spanish. And Cully is working with Schoolhouse Press more and more. He and his wife, Michelle, who's also a teacher at the University of Wisconsin, she teaches English, and she helps us out at Schoolhouse Press as well. So, and my grandchildren are absolutely splendid, so don't get me started.
You know, I don't think that except online, I have actually ever seen anything that Cully has designed live. I certainly have heard Cully play music before. And for our listeners, I want to say that he's a phenomenal musician.
Yes, he is.
From what I see online, he looks like a very talented designer as well.
Yes, he's doing a lot of garments, sweaters and hats and unique construction. And he's also become an excellent editor. I'm not sure how that happened, because to edit knitting books is a separate skill. And he's just, you know, the recent books we've published have all been edited by Cully, Knitting with Two Colors, Knit One, Knit All. And we're working on another one now. And his skill just amazes me. And all the SPPs were putting out individual leaflets of designs called Schoolhouse Press Patterns, stuff of my mother's and mine and Cully's and other designers like Elizabeth Upitis. And we just put out one of Joyce Williams's wonderful designs. We miss her so much. And Sven Daniel Gillenman, who lives in Holland, we've just published one of his patterns. And Cully is just doing a masterly job of editing. I'm very impressed and grateful.
I think that's fantastic. You know, of course, I know that when you have family in the business, there is a level of quality and caring that goes into the product.
Yes, truly. He's part of it, heart and soul. And he's teaching also. He will be at Vogue Knitting Live in Chicago this November, teaching both the Baby Surprise Jacket, the original one of my ma's, and his adaptation of knitting it in the round in stocking stitch and color pattern and maintaining the shape and integral design of the original Baby Surprise Jacket.
That is fantastic. That is truly remarkable. Will you make sure that when you see your family, give them my best, please?
I absolutely will. Thank you.
So let's start out with the obvious. Let's have you talk to us about yourself and Schoolhouse Press. I realize that's a big subject, but I think our listeners would rather than me taking you down a list of questions, let's just have you tell us about yourself and Schoolhouse Press. Give us a little history.
Yeah, well, it is a huge subject. Let me see where it would begin. I guess it began when my ma, who had been selling a lot of her designs to magazines back in the 50s and 60s, could not get used to the fact that editors of magazines were altering her instructions. She knitted all her garments in the round in seamless construction, and her instructions were being altered to knit the pieces back and forth and sew them together. And it got more and more annoying. By the way, back in the 50s and 60s, there were no bylines. So she was a little bit grateful for that. It was never mentioned that she was the designer, except very occasionally when it was a huge article. And she finally got fed up with it and wrote her own instructions and published them in a single-sheet newsletter. That was in 1958. I was a mere child at the time. And it was a sweater that had been on the cover of a Bernat magazine, a beautiful Fair Isle Yoke sweater, in which they had actually drawn in seams in the body of the sweater to match their instructions, which changed from circular to flat. So she reproduced that herself, and that was the beginning. That was 1958, and she had found some wool in Grand Marais, Minnesota. I remember we were going on a camping trip, and we stopped in Grand Marais to get supplies. We always went into the wilderness and never saw anyone for 2 weeks, so we had to take a lot of stuff with us. And my mom was kind of wandering through the 5- and 10-cent store in Grand Marais, and under the counter found a 5-pound bundle of beautiful, natural, unbleached, undyed sheep's wool, and she bought the whole thing. My father was horrified. It was 20 skeins. He thought, "You're never going to use that up." Anyway, she got in touch with the mill, which was the Cambridge Woolen Mill in Cambridge, Minnesota. Ed Bjorklund, I remember him. And she started to sell the wool and advertise it through the little single sheet newsletter that she'd begun to publish herself twice a year in March and September. And then she had some wool dyed, some of Ed's natural sheep's wool. She had it dyed Loden green and a beautiful honey color. And then she had him custom spin sheep's down for us. And this just progressed through the years. Through the years, she did some television, local television programs. The Beulah Donahue Show. Boy, how do I remember this stuff? And it was like a 15-minute television program. And apparently, Beulah said that the station was swamped with requests for her newsletter and that they had the greatest response ever since a guy was on giving away free flower seeds. And let's see what happened after that. Then I guess because of that, she got tapped to do a public television series called The Busy Knitter, which was a 13-week series of knitting. Let's see, the first one was the ski sweater. Yes, oh, and I think that's how she and Elaine met. I think Elaine was watching the program on public television and wrote to her. And I think Elaine said they could only get the program every now and then, so, you know, she didn't get to see or hear all of them, little sporadic bursts. And then a second series. Because the first was popular, they had her do a second series for a seamless raglan sweater, either cardigan or pullover. And that was the series that my ma wanted to call The Busy Knitter Rides Again, but they wouldn't let her. It was called Busy Knitter 2, and it also was shown around the country on public television stations. And Schoolhouse Press, it wasn't even Schoolhouse Press back then. It was called Elizabeth Zimmerman Limited. That was the name of her company. And let's see, then when after Chris and I were married and we lived in New York City and we moved out to the kind of the country, New Hope, Pennsylvania, and I set up a small shop there and I became Elizabeth Zimmerman Limited's branch in the East. Then I started taking trips into Manhattan to visit various publication editors. Burnett and McCall's and Spinnerin and selling designs to them and knitting them up in their wool. And then I guess Chris and I had moved to upstate New York by then, to Trumansburg, where he was working with Bob Moog helping develop Polyphonic Synthesizer. And I had sold my own designs to Woman's Day, and that was the first time I had was in a magazine with my own name attached to three yoke sweaters. And that was in the 60-something or other, 66, 65. And then, let's see, we lived there for a number of years in Trumansburg, New York, while Chris worked with Moog. And we started coming here for the summers when the kids were little, like in second and third grade, I think. And then going back to New York at the end of the summer, we were refurbishing an old schoolhouse my parents had bought at an auction and turning it into a livable place. It had no running water, and, you know, Chris and my father were redoing it. And then in the early 70s, we actually moved here, lock, stock, and barrel. And in the late 70s, we convinced my mother to write her third book. She had written Knitting Without Tears and Knitter's Almanac and couldn't find a publisher for her third book. So Chris and I convinced her to write another one, and we would publish it. And Chris came up with the name Schoolhouse Press, since each of us lived in old refurbished schoolhouses. My parents in a little old brick schoolhouse in Babcock, Wisconsin, and our family here in an old frame schoolhouse in Pittsville. So that was the birth of Schoolhouse Press, was 1980, I guess 80 or 81, with the publication of Knitting Workshop.
So let's back up there a little bit. There's two points I wanted to make from your conversation. You are absolutely correct about the series. Your mom is 100% responsible for Elaine, my partner, Elaine Raleigh, the R in XRX, getting into the knitting world and starting her own yarn store, which from that probably morphed. Well, I mean, the yarn store morphed from that to the magazine, to the events and the books. So probably if you trace it back, your mom is responsible for, you know, what we do here today. It's definitely inspired Elaine. And I know that the series really empowered Elaine. And Elaine is one of the best knitters I know.
Yes. That's wonderful. Yeah. No, that's wonderful. I'm sure my mom would be thrilled to hear that.
The second thing I wanted to say is, you know, we talk about Meg's mom, and let's make sure, for the sake of a brand new person that may not know, we are talking about Elizabeth Zimmerman here. The idea that your mother had a book and couldn't find a publisher, because if she had a book now, I mean, publishers would be just, you know, roaring to get at it. The idea that you guys couldn't find a publisher for it is amazing to me.
Yeah, no, it was very surprising. I thought so, too. Her first book, Knitting Without Tears, did very well and actually has kind of made history as a how-to book that has never been out of print since 1971. And Scribner's, which became Macmillan, which became about 14 other things and is now Simon & Schuster, they advertise it as a classic because it is unusual for a how-to book to remain in print for that steadily and consistently. Even all of Barbara Walker's books went out of print at one time. So that did very well. And then the second one, Knitter's Almanac, did less well. And they never, Scribner's never even reprinted it a second time. It got picked up by Dover. But they were reluctant to go for a third. And we tried a couple of other publishers, and they all said, no, thank you. So that's when, you know, we got like The Little Red Hen, I'll do it myself. So we teamed up and we rented an IBM Selectric typewriter. God, can you imagine? This was in like 1980, 79 or 80. And Chris and I typed out the book. We had taped another television series, another 13-week television series, and we kind of worked with my mother writing, and we transcribed stuff she had said in the TV series, and that's what formed the book, Knitting Workshop, that accompanied the Knitting Workshop television series, which showed around the country and was exceptionally popular in Canada. They ran it more times than anyone in this country. And the book was kind of an amendment or an adjunct to the TV series. And actually, I guess now is the time to let it out that we're redoing Knitting Workshop. It was typed on the typewriter, and it was all black and white, and it had a bunch of mistakes and a bunch of omissions, and Cully has grabbed it by the scruff of its neck and has shaken it up, and we're preserving all my mother's original text in Knitting Workshop, but we're adding editor's notes all over the place to expand the instructions for various garments, to give multiple sizes and detailed instructions. My mother was never one to hold your hand, you know, as when it came to knitting directions. She always said, your brains are as good as mine, and she would give us kind of a sketchy outline of what to do and leave it up to you to kind of design your own. So we're accommodating today's knitter and giving stitch-by-stitch instructions, or at least much more detailed than my ma ever did, and re-photographing everything. Of course, it'll be in full color. And I found every single sweater that was in the original book except one, so they'll all be seen again now in color. And the total new format and new design is going to be absolutely beautiful. We hope it'll come out this fall or winter.
How exciting. And, so they can keep up to date with that up on your website, schoolhousepress.com?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No. Well, no problem. This is going to be a very, very big thing. I can't wait for it to come out.
Yeah, I'm pleased with it, too. It was high time to give it a new breath of life because it's been selling consistently since 1981. But, you know, it needed a bit of a facelift, and that's what Cully and I are doing.
How exciting. That is a wonderful project. Well, you know, kudos for Cully, too. That's great.
Yeah.
So let's step back for a minute and talk a little bit about the Wool Gathering. I mean, it's such an iconic piece as well. The publication history, as you talked about before, started with your mom, but at some point it evolved. And so what is it that you and your mom wanted to do with the Wool Gathering?
Yeah, well, it was started as the single sheet newsletter in 1958, and by 1968, that was when Cully was born, and that was the publication of the baby surprise sweater, which was designed while I was pregnant with Cully. My mom designed it for him, and so it's kind of fitting that he redid it as a stocking stitch color pattern garment. But anyway, the newsletters went for 10 years, and we reprinted all of them in my mom's fifth book, The Opinionated Knitter, reprinted each of the original newsletters with updated versions and contemporary variations of those old designs knitted by many, many people who submitted sweaters for us to photograph. And anyway, so in 1968, my mom wanted a wider format than that single legal size sheet, and she started the Wool Gathering with the pie shawl. That was the first design for Wool Gathering number one. And I'm trying to remember when I came on board. I think it was around issue number 10, maybe, or 11. I started to have a page in the Wool Gathering as her branch in the East, you know, with shop news and wool news and updated things like that. And then gradually I started contributing to the designs, and it became the 12-page booklet that it is now. And actually we're in the right on the cusp this minute of altering the format of the Wool Gathering. We're certainly not going to abandon it. We'll keep publishing it, but it will probably be in an electronic version. We're still trying to figure out how to do that and accommodate people who have remains of subscriptions yet to go. But that's how it exists to this day, and it always contains an original design of either mine or my mother's or Cully's, and reviews of books that we like, and general knitting chit-chat.
Yeah, well, it's great. I love the Wool Gathering, and I love its sensibilities. It's just a very approachable publication.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yes. And Cully's helping enormously now with editing and finding egregious mistakes. I'm so grateful that he's there.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Your mom was one of those extremely charismatic people. I had the pleasure of actually meeting her and your dad when I was a little kid a couple of times. Was she the kind of person that was big on technical editing, or was not so much? Not so much.
Well, you know, as I say, her instructions were rather sketchy. She counted on the reader / knitter to bring their own ideas to a general method of construction, you know, a general outline, as it might be the shirt yoke sweater or any of her 11 ways to finish a seamless yoke sweater from the bottom up. She had 11 different ways to complete the yoke between the underarms and the neck. And she counted on you to use your own brains. I guess it was the mode in which she grew up as a knitter. She was born and brought up in England, and young girls automatically knitted. She said it was as automatic as kids today watching TV or playing video games. Girls knitted. So it was just something she did all her life, and there never were written instructions. It was always a verbal communication between knitters. And so that's how she always designed, and she gave her patterns and instructions kind of in that mode and left a lot of it up to you, so that anyone who followed her general outline would actually come up with their own creation, and it would be unique to them.
Well, she was a talented designer, but she was, again, I want to go back to just how charismatic she was.
Yeah.
You know, at the Golden Fleece, when I was a kid, we had the good fortune of having her teach, I think, a couple of times. And you could just see she held the entire class. You know, they were in awe of her. I mean, she had that kind of an amazing presence. And she never failed to make people feel like what they did, even as beginners, even if it wasn't great, that it was just perfect and wonderful.
Yeah. She was wonderful that way. I'm glad that she taught me that skill, because there always is something positive to say no matter what. And she was very, very funny, and you know, intelligent and well read. And if you've read any of her books, I love Knitter's Almanac. It's one of my favorites. That's, you've kind of met her if you've read her prose, because she wrote just the way she talked. And yes, she was very amusing. Well, this is a weird story, but when Vogue Knitting was first republished, I think that was in the 70s. And remember, you don't remember, you're too young, but it existed. It was a classic knitting magazine, and then it disappeared for a number of years, and then it was brought back. And she was asked to write a regular column, and this was during knitting camp. And she asked the campers, I think Vogue had already published one issue, and it didn't do well because it had a whole bunch of patterns or garments in it, designs in it, but no instructions. You had to send in for the directions. So everyone was really annoyed, you know, knitters were really annoyed by that format. And so my mother asked the knitting campers if she should write for Vogue Knitting. And she really wanted to, because she admired it so much. And they all said, no, it's don't associate yourself with it. They're not doing well. And you'd be like one good apple in a barrel of rotten apples. It wouldn't work. And my mother said, aha, but perhaps I could be a cup of bleach in a load of dirty laundry. And, of course, she had every intention of writing for Vogue, and she was going to, you know, she asked, pretended to ask them, but she knew what the answer was and managed to swing it around into her favor to be one of Vogue's, writers, one of their regular article writers.
Well, I mean, it's fantastic that she looked at the challenge and the opportunity as opposed to, you know, PR. I think that is pretty typical of your whole family. You run your own race.
Well, she wanted to promote knitting. That's the main thing, is to expand the ideas about knitting. And so, of course, a magazine is an excellent format and through which to do that. And, you know, she certainly participated a lot in the early days of Knitters Magazine as well, for that very same reason, to help spread the word.
Absolutely, and yes, yeah, and we're so fortunate that she was so generous with us. So let's talk about your DVDs. At some point, you decided to do some DVDs, and you had some in-house professional help with that. Of course, I'm speaking of your husband, Chris. Can you tell our listeners about your husband, Chris?
Oh, boy. That's another big subject. He was an extraordinary kind of a Renaissance guy. He was a composer and musician by trade, but he graduated from Dartmouth pre-med, and he had a double major, pre-med and music, and then decided to pursue music and went to Berklee School of Music and the Manhattan School of Music and became a member of Stan Kenton's band and traveled around the world. And he was amazing. Grammy nominated for one of his albums that he did with Phil Woods. He wrote all the tunes, arranged them all, and played, performed. And let's see how that started. Yes, we started by wanting to do the video to accompany, to do knitting workshop video. And we rented video equipment from a place in Minneapolis, and we filmed my ma doing the knitting workshop series, and it was shown on television. And then Chris and I decided to do, you know, individual videos. I know that word doesn't exist anymore, but of single garments. And the first one we did was the Turkish Icelandic coat. And it was rather rough. It's not available at all anymore. But then we started, Chris got the idea that we could start traveling around the country and do a different video maybe once or twice a year, and combine them with you know, going to beautiful places like the Oregon coast or the Smoky Mountains, and we call them knitting vacations. And we would take wool and needles and a notebook, and I actually would cast on and knit the actual sweater for the first time through while Chris taped it, and he would tape something going on, and then we would have a hiatus for a day or so while I caught up to a next interesting bit on the garment, and then he'd tape the next bit, and we'd go through a couple of weeks like that, just oozing up and down the coast or wherever we happened to be, through the Smokies or through, God, we went to a lot of places around Tucson and Flagstaff and, you know, various parts of the country. And it was really rather nice. And then we'd come back here and he would edit it and put music to it. And there it was available to our customers as a video. And then soon DVDs came along. And I think, Chris had died when our last video we did together was a Fair Isle vest that we taped in Door County on Washington Island. We rented a beautiful old Icelandic log house right on the water and did a video of knitting a Fair Isle vest from casting on through corrugated ribbing and all the different patterns and the calculations and steeking and shaping, and it was really lovely. And he died just as he was finishing the edit on that, and that's where Cully stepped in. He wasn't involved in Schoolhouse Press at all. He was living in Minneapolis and working as a musician, and he stepped in and finished up the edit and found the music that Chris had designated for this particular tape. Very touching, lovely music, like a farewell. And that was the last one we did together. Cully said, you know, videos don't, a couple of years later, video, nobody has video machines anymore, everyone has DVDs, so he started converting all the old videos onto DVD, including the two of my mother's videos that were still available, her original public television series that had been stored in the PBS vaults in Washington, D.C. When I finally tracked them down decades later, the early tape was not very good quality, and even though they were stored in hermetically sealed vaults with temperature controls and everything, there was severe dropout and the tapes were absolutely useless. So both Busy Knitter and Busy Knitter 2 were destroyed, sadly, but the ones that we had done ourselves we were able to convert to DVD, and then all the Knitting Vacation garments that Chris and I did together are now on DVDs as well. And we've done a couple of new ones too, with Cully at the helm as the videographer and the composer, and he's kind of stepped into his father's shoes, and it's kind of nice, isn't it?
Well, it's amazing. You are surrounded and have always been surrounded by so many creative people. That are your family. I mean, that's got to be an amazing experience to know that, you know, you can reach out to somebody right next to you and they have the skill set and the passion to help you bring this to fruition.
Yeah, it's lovely, and you know exactly what that's like in another family-owned business of XRX. So, yeah, I'm sitting in the living room right now and just looking at my walls are completely covered with mostly Chris's paintings. That was another one of his skills. So, yeah, I feel very fortunate.
Well, and, folks, I wanted to say that, and I hope Meg doesn't mind, I've actually visited at your house.
Yes.
And there's beautiful things up everywhere. I mean, it is, you should, you know, not that you would ever do it, but you should just charge for admission to come and have people look at your walls.
It's a cluttered museum. Yes, you were here with your wife and your beautiful children. I remember it well.
Yep, I've been there a couple of times back when I used to fix your Mac.
Yes, I bought one of my new Macs when you had your business in Rochester. Lowy and I drove over there and I bought a computer from you.
Yes
you were our guy.
I was like,
yeah, that was
another life. Another life.
Yes,
so, yes,
another
I used to be a mega geek. Now I'm coming back as a geek again. All right, let's move off of me. And
full circle.
Let's move off of me. I'd like to talk about your design career and your books. And can you talk about some of the highlights and the milestones of your design career and the books you've written?
Well, yeah, the first design I remember well, I don't remember the year, I'm terrible at dates, but it was that Woman's Day issue that I talked about, and there were two adults and two children's sweaters knitted with the unspun Icelandic, which was another highlight when I was a kid, well, you know, an airhead teen. I was going to school in Germany, and during one of the holidays, we had a three-week holiday, and I went home with one of my classmates who happened to be an Icelandic woman, Hanna Gunnarsdottir, and I lived with her and her family for the three-week vacation, and that's where I discovered the unspun wheels of Icelandic wool. I'd never seen or heard of anything like it in my life. So I immediately bought a bunch and knitted a sweater while I was in Reykjavik and sent home a whole bunch of wheels to my ma. And she got equally excited, and she began to import it. And this was back in the 60s, like the early 60s, as it might be 61. Can you imagine? That was decades before Reynolds had Lopi. And so that was a huge event in my knitting life, was the discovery of that wool, which remains my favorite. We are the U.S. distributor for it now in the unspun Icelandic. And it's the most versatile wool I know. You can knit with it in a single strand. You can knit tightly at about 7 or 8 stitches to the inch. I've made the Swedish Dubbelmosse at that gauge. And I've also knitted it in a single strand on size 10.5 needles to make beautiful lace shawls. And even though it's unspun, once it's knitted up, even at an enormous gauge, it's as strong as any commercially spun wool. And then, of course, you can double it to make sweaters and 2-ply. You can make 3-ply jackets. My mom knitted a huge blanket in 4-ply, kind of a bedspread. And we're actually waiting right this minute. The ship left Reykjavik on the 28th of August, and our new order contains 10 new colors that they've dyed as a temporary offering, and they're neon colors, the hottest pink you ever saw, kind of fluorescent greens and yellows and bright sky cobalt blue, and I can hardly wait to see them in person. They should be docking even as we speak and being trucked over to us next week, I hope. So Icelandic wool, yes, that was huge. What was the other part? Oh, yeah, books. God, what was the first book I did? I must admit that I concentrate mostly on my mother and her designs and her publications. She still is the main guru, and I am happy to follow in her wake. The first book I think I did was just a compilation of wool gatherings I had done called Hand Knitting with Meg Swanson, a little paperback, and it's still available. I think there are 7 or 8 designs in there. And then I did a book with Interweave Press called Knitting. And then I did a compilation, not my book, but I gathered together a bunch of extraordinary designers to do the XRX book, A Gathering of Lace. And then, oh, yeah, Sweaters from Camp. That was another gathering of talented knitters. We had knitting campers. We asked anyone who wanted to participate to design an all-over patterned sweater in Shetland jumper weight wool, and we got some amazing designs. And that book, it took us 10 years to sell one printing. Can you imagine? I mean, knitting wasn't very popular then. It was around 2000. Knitting was not as popular as it is now by a long shot, and people were rather afraid of knitting at a fine gauge in multicolors. Now, of course, they're all knitting socks at 10 to the inch. It's wonderful. So after Sweaters from Camp, boy, you'd think I'd know this. What did I do next? I guess maybe it was, Armenian Knitting with Joyce Williams. Oh, that was a thrill. Discovering Armenian knitting, that was another high point in my knitting life. It was the Philadelphia Museum of Art was mounting a retrospective of Elsa Schiaparelli, who was just an extraordinary woman in so many areas of the arts, but we particularly know about her because of the bow knot sweater that's photographed in most history books. It's a speckled black sweater with a knitted in large white bow. And, you know, I'd known about it most of my knitting life, but never really thought about it. And the museum contacted me and asked if I would supply the wool for a kit they were going to offer for instructions how to knit that sweater. So I said, sure. They said the original one was knitted in Shetland lace weight wool. So I said, sure, and sent them a bunch of lace weight. And they then contacted me again and said, you know, 12 to the inch is a little cruel. We think we're going to shift to jumper weight at about 7 or 8 to the inch. So I sent them a bunch of jumper weight. And then they said, would you please go over the instructions that we've received from Elsa's heirs and assigns, that they've given us permission to reprint this. Would you mind going over the instructions and helping us with the charts and stuff like that? So I said, sure. And they sent them, and I immediately called Joyce Williams and said, help, Joycey, and sent copies of the pattern to her. And she called me, and she was so excited. And she said, I just realized how this thing was knitted. It was not intarsia, which we had always assumed that the white bow was knitted in intarsia. The entire sweater was knitted with two colors. Even the solid black part before the bow began was knitted with two colors. And the second color, the white, was being carried and trapped across the back of the solid black section until it was kneaded. And then there it was, ready to knit. So what we had thought was a tweedy black wool was actually flecks of the second color, the white color, being trapped behind the black and showing through in little flecks that made it look tweedy. Well, we got so excited. And then, of course, we looked at the original photograph again that's been in all the knitting books. And if we paid attention, we would have immediately seen that the top of the sweater is solid black, but in the inside of the neck opening, you can clearly see that there's a stranded white color being carried across the solid black part. If we paid attention, we would have said, wait a minute, something weird is going on. So it was called Armenian knitting, and we, to this day, don't know. We've been in touch with Armenian communities around the world, in Australia and New Zealand and in Paris and in Fresno, and I've been in touch with a woman there who, so many people know so much about textiles, but no one's ever been able to source the origin of this technique. And the remaining fabric is really like a woven fabric. Because of the continuous carried strand of the second color, all elasticity is eliminated from the garment. It literally becomes a piece of weaving with the carried strand as the weft thread. So you have to think of it completely differently. So Joyce and I got very excited, and we immediately became obsessed, and each turned out about 3 or 4 designs. Joyce's are absolutely staggering. And we put them out together as a book called Armenian Knitting. So I'm sorry, that was a long story about another one of my books. And then I guess the latest one is Knitting with Two Colors, which I collaborated with Amy Dachin to put out. Amy has been my assistant at Knitting Camp for 18 years, can you imagine? Anyway, I'm digressing. And I think I've mentioned them all. I hope I haven't omitted something.
Well, I according to my list, you got them all. How is Amy these days?
Amy's doing very well. She's become a national teacher. She teaches at all the Vogue events and at Madrona, and she's leading a group of knitters to Ireland in the spring, and she's doing very well and got quite a name for herself in the knitting world.
Yeah, I've been following her as well. I saw her at TNNA, and I took a look at her Craftsy.com class. Very exciting stuff.
Yes, I forgot to mention that. She's just done a seamless yoked sweater for Craftsy, and it's doing very, very well. She's got a lot of fans through that.
Well, that's great. And, I know that you've been working together for a long time. So you talked about camp. And so let's talk about camp, because this is a big thing. I have never been to a camp, which I cannot believe I've never been to a camp. But I have spoken to a ton of people that have, including a mutual friend of ours, Franklin Habit. And everybody who talks about camp, raves about it. Last year was a big anniversary for your camp.
Yes, 40 years. Yes, unbelievable. Yeah, I didn't go to the very first one. That was 1974, and it was at Shell Lake, held through the University of Wisconsin. And one of the weaving teachers, Charlene Birmingham, was a friend of my ma's and asked if she would be willing to teach a knitting class, and she said sure. And a little handful of knitters showed up, two of which, Jean Krebs and Lois Young, had never missed a year. Lois still hasn't. Jean died the year before last, but had never missed a year coming to camp, and Lois Young has never missed a year. She's been to all 40 sessions of knitting camp. It's been amazing. So it grew from my ma starting it at Shell Lake. I came the second year, 1975. I think that was the year David, Elaine, and Alexi were there as well. And yes, we were chatting in the back of the room, and my mother had to yell at us. She reprimanded Alexi and myself for talking during class. And I actually remember what David and I were talking about. I was knitting a Stonington shawl that's mainly garter stitch, a diagonal garter stitch center and four garter stitch trapezoids, and then a lace edging. And I was just starting the trapezoid section, and David suggested that I run a bit of lace down the center of each trapezoid, and I did that. I remember that was what we were muttering about in the back of the room, annoying my mother. Anyway, so we did Shell Lake for a number of years, and Chris and Gaff, my father, and the kids would swim and sail and fish while my mother and I taught class. And then after a bunch of years, the kids kind of didn't want to go. They had other stuff going on. And so we moved the camp to the University of Wisconsin in Marshfield, the extension there. And Alexi actually came as a guest speaker to one of those two. I can't remember what year that was. So we held it there for a number of years, and then and people could take it for credit, It was a continuing education. It was run through the CE department, and people could get credit for taking it. It was quite interesting. Anyway, the head of it, Barbara Allmendinger, retired, and we kind of wondered what would happen, and my mother had retired by then as well, and we didn't hear and didn't hear and didn't hear, and then Chris and I said, well, they haven't asked us to come back. Why don't we take it on and do it ourselves? So we did, and we started doing it at the Best Western Hotel, and it's been going ever since. The Best Western closed, and we moved to the brand new Holiday Inn, just got built in Marshfield, so we shifted to the new Holiday Inn. And last year was our 40th year. It is amazing. I'm probably not the person to talk to about it objectively because I'm so involved, but it's the most extraordinary mix of knitters from all over the world. We have four sessions now. We've been doing that for the last, 10 years or so, four sessions back to back to back to back, two camps and two retreats. And we have people, from Spain and the UK and New Zealand and Israel, and another guy, Felipe, is coming back again to our mini camp this fall. He's from Sao Paulo, Brazil. And it's got a life of its own. It's become an amazing event. We're doing another mini session the first weekend in October. We have what we call a mini camp with a maximum of 25 people. And because the camps, in each session of camp, there are around 50 or 60. And, of course, Chris, again, here I lean heavily on Chris, he came up with a method to teach a large number of people in a most efficient manner. We have four huge TV monitors in the camp room, and I'm at the head of the room with a camera aimed over my shoulder at my hands, and I have a small monitor to make sure I stay on camera. And so I can demonstrate techniques to a group of 50 or 60, and we're all on the same page at the same moment. Everyone has, you know, their monitor that they can see, and we can, you know, I'll go over a technique maybe four or five times, and we're all doing it together. And it's just an amazing way to teach efficiently a large number of people. And that's another thing I think that's unique about camp. We cover all topics in one group. We all stay together. We don't bust up into small groups with multiple teachers. We all stay as a family together and go through just about anything the campers ask for. I have a vague outline at the sessions that I teach at, but you know me, I'm always ready to digress and veer off into another topic. So the campers really do direct the flow of the teaching. But with the cameras and the monitors, it's a marvelous way to teach.
Well, and I've seen that set up before. Once upon a time, I think it was our first West Coast Stitches. I think we
yes.
set up something like that for you.
You did indeed, yes. It
yes,
was in Oakland.
Yes, I actually think it was probably in Burlingame.
Oh, was it? I bet you're
that
right.
That hotel? I think it was.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was.
Yeah.
I think we were having computer issues, and I had to come and fix a computer issue, too. I think.
Sounds likely.
Sounds likely. Mm-hmm. So the camps, for our listeners who are interested in camp, are there any openings in the upcoming camps, or is it just completely sold out as usual?
Well, we do put the application goes online in February. And it's not first come, first serve the way it used to be. We figured that was unfair. That was back in the days of mail, and people who had access to FedEx had an unfair advantage. So we just take all the applications. It's open for 10 days, I think. And at the end of 10 days, we just see if we're overflowing in any of the camps, and we literally put everybody's name into a knitted hat, and we pick out the overflow names, and they get put on a waiting list. But, you know, people's lives are such that nearly everyone on the waiting list gets an opportunity to come. People have to cancel for various reasons. And we pretty much accommodate just about everybody. That's how we started these little mini camps, was we had such a large overflow that we started this secondary small camp to offer another camp experience to the people who were on the waiting list. So it's pretty fair, and, you know, in February, just apply if you're interested, and you've got a good shot of getting accepted.
And our listeners can apply up again at schoolhousepress.com, correct?
Yes, and the applications become available in February. I can't remember the actual date, but, you know, there's information on our website right now. The dates for 2014 have been posted.
And as I understand it, Kali is now teaching at camp as well?
Well, he did a couple of guest spots last summer, mainly for this circular stranded surprise jacket. And so, you know, he'll be doing that on a limited basis. We haven't officially, you know, made any huge transformation yet. But, yes, he's becoming a louder and louder voice at Schoolhouse Press.
That's fantastic. So I'd like to make sure that I ask about your teaching schedule. Of course, you're doing camps. Are you out there in the world going to any events or shops doing signings or lecturing or teaching?
Not really. I've kind of, you know, pulled up the drawbridge a little bit. I did, you know, a bunch of the large events, the first Interweave Press convention and a couple of Vogue Knitting Lives. And I'm just kind of staying closer to home these days. I will be talking to the Madison Knitting Guild next year. They booked me for, she said in December, and I said, oh, sure, I can do that. And then it turned out to be December 2014. So so I guess I'm booked for that. But other than that, just knitting camp. And I do local things from time to time. I talked to the Cultural Center in Wisconsin Rapids. I gave a one-day workshop and book signing. So, you know, I'm around. But mostly it's online. You know, I answer questions, multiple knitting questions almost every day. And we have our own electronic newsletter that goes out for free that I always do a Q&A in there, too, of people who have written in questions about knitting. And so I don't really have a teaching schedule per se.
So I've noticed that you're more and more online. Schoolhouse Press has a Facebook page, and I'm going to encourage our listeners to go up and like it so they can keep in touch with you.
How yes, thank
is
you.
Social, no problem. How is the social media thing going for you? Because, you know, as somebody that does social media sort of all the time, it's exhausting. And how are you liking that?
Well, I love it. I'm not on it every day. I do pace myself. I don't go onto Facebook maybe every couple of days, but I have an individual Facebook page, and then there's a Schoolhouse Press Facebook page. And actually, we're on the cusp of doing a rather large event. Barbara Walker, who is, we have published all of her knitting books, seven knitting books. She contacted me about 4 or 5 months ago and asked if Schoolhouse Press would please auction off a bunch of her sweaters. Can you imagine?
Wow.
And I said, sure. And, you know, she's very efficient. About 4 days later, the 3 or 4 enormous cardboard boxes arrived. She sent about 80 pieces of knitting that she has done that she said, now I live in Florida, and they're just filling up closet space, and I don't wear them anymore, and I just as soon, you know, spread them out among knitters who are interested. So we have these historic items, mostly sweaters, mostly knitted from the top, a number of suits, skirts and jackets, or skirts and sweaters, or three-piece suits, two-piece suits, a number of tablecloths, a bunch of shawls, some tabards, a pair of leggings. I mean, just amazing stuff, and everything, you know, knitted to perfection. And she said that she has never hired another knitter to knit a single stitch, and she has never used a machine. So every single garment was knitted by Barbara herself, and there's a string tag on each one with the name of the garment and her signature to validate them. And so we're having this series of auctions to sell off all these pieces that Barbara knitted. And if you go to our Schoolhouse Press Facebook page, we'll keep you updated with dates. But it's beginning on the 24th of October is going to begin the first 10-day auction. And then there will be a series of 3, and they'll each be 10 days, so it'll end just before Thanksgiving. And starting on the 24th of October, and about a week before that, we'll be posting the lookbooks on our website so that you can peruse all the garments that will be available and decide which ones you might like to bid on. And so, you know, it's kind of an exciting event. It's been an incredible amount of work having to photograph each one and for the auction, and then for the lookbook, all the detail close-ups of each garment and describe them and all that, but it's we're honored to be able to do this for Barbara.
That is incredible. This is huge news, Barbara Hooligans. You're going to want to get out to the Facebook page, the Schoolhouse Facebook page, and I'll post links about that on the Ravelry group at Arrows. And you, I really recommend that you go up and to schoolhousepress.com and sign up for that e-newsletter that they put out so that you don't miss something as cool as this is.
Yeah, it's kind of exciting.
So I understand that there's another Elizabeth Zimmerman book. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we've published several of her books posthumously, as they say. The first one I did was The Opinionated Knitter, which has all the newsletters that we talked about before. I loved doing that book. It was kind of my reward. At the end of every business day, I'd spend an hour or two working on that book. It was a nice way to deal with my ma's death to kind of continue conversing with her through that. And then a couple of years ago, Cully started rummaging around through my Ma's designs, and she had always wanted to write a garter stitch book, and again, fell on deaf ears as far as finding a publisher. So he amalgamated all the garter stitch designs that had not ever appeared in any of her previous books and put them all together into a book called Knit One, Knit All, which was the name she had come up with. She had two titles, Great Garter Stitch or Knit One, Knit All. And so he picked that title and edited all these amazing garments, and we had a number of different knitters knit them up and verify the instructions. So that's, I'm very pleased and proud of that book. Cully did a wonderful job. And then, of course, the knitting workshop books, which we hope will be out this winter.
And this book, this most recent book, Knit One, Knit All, and that's available right now?
Yes, that was published about 2 years ago. Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry I missed it, Meg, but
I should send you a copy. I don't know why you're not on my list to get a copy. Also, we're publishing these Schoolhouse Press patterns, the individual designs. We're up to issue number 46. We just published number 46. So that's an ongoing product of ours.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you for sharing that. Meg, before we wrap this up, I'd like to ask you if you have a final message like you'd like to share with our listeners.
I guess overall, I'm so pleased at the direction hand knitting has taken. I never dreamed that it would ever become this huge or this mainstream or this popular. And the new designers are doing such extraordinary things. I'm just bowled over by some of the new techniques and designs that are being published. The skill and the imagination, it's absolutely stunning. But especially I'm pleased, and it's an enormous satisfaction to realize that my mom is still extant in the knitting world and that so many of her ideas and designs have entered into the knitting language. And I know that she's flapping around up there, and I think she's very pleased as well. And I especially thank you, Benjamin, for giving me this opportunity to blather on about all the stuff I love so much about knitting.
Oh, Meg, it was such a thrill for me, and I can't thank you enough for joining me. This has been such a treat, and I'm going to speak for my listeners and thank you on their behalf as well. It truly was a remarkable interview, and I do appreciate your time.
Oh, wonderful, and I thank you too.
That was Meg Swanson of Schoolhouse Press. You can keep up with what Meg is doing at schoolhousepress.com, and that's one you're going to want to bookmark. Next Monday, my guest will be my friend, Johnny Vasquez. Johnny is the lead instructor at the Yarn Craft Academy and co-author of the 30-Day Sweater. As head honcho at Yarn Nation, he works to provide resources that help grow the fiber arts industry and allow yarn lovers to enjoy their craft more fully. He'll be joining us to tell us about his work and a new project he's starting called the 30-Day Sweater, an ambitious project that I think has a lot of promise. Before that show, I've scheduled an extra episode of Fiber Hooligan for this Thursday. I get a lot of requests and suggestions about who to have as guests on the show. The one that has been most requested is the team that makes Stitches Expos happen. People have told me that they want to hear about how the shows work and what it takes to make an event like Stitches happen. So I've decided to have Mavis Smith, our customer service manager and the person who takes care of all the teachers, Lisa Manis, who does a lot of our marketing and PR and who takes all the pictures of the shows, and Christy Miller, a.k.a. Knitter's Brat, who takes care of all the vendors and sponsors in the market, on the show next week for a special extra episode on Thursday at 11 a.m. Central Time. They're going to be talking about all things Stitches and giving highlights to our upcoming show in Hartford, Connecticut in November. With a little luck, they won't tell too many stories about me. And we're probably going to be giving away a few prizes for our live listeners. These are remarkable women, and I hope you'll join us for the show. For those of you who may have missed anything in this podcast, I invite you to join us on our Ravelry group, Fiber Hooligans, or in our Fiber Hooligans Facebook group. Our moderator, Tammy Burke, does a great job of making sure we answer questions and provide follow-up to any questions. I also want to make sure that you know that I'm eager to hear from you. You can email me questions, recommendations, critiques, and feedback at benjamin@fiberhooligan.com. I don't promise to respond to every email or message, but I do promise to do my best to read them all. If you ask a really great question or have an inspired idea, or maybe even just because I'm feeling feisty, I may even read your email or message on the podcast. That's our show, Barbara Hooligans. As we slide on out of here today, I'd like to wish you all a glorious week. Remember, the only thing better than being creative is being kind to each other. The good news, you can do both. Thank you for spending this time with us. I'll see you next week on another edition of Barbara Hooligans.